Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So the title of this talk is Becoming Human, Barbie Storytelling and Aquinas on Self-Knowledge. And here's the prelude. As the opening credits fade, exterior shot of a movie theater with a crowd forming long lines converging at the doors. The crowd includes many children and families, as well as adults in singles, pairs, and groups, all ages, all kinds of dress, but pink is a noticeably dominant color. Cut to close-up of members of the crowd, emphasizing diversity with camera panning over in turn a group of little girls wearing princess dresses, a teenager rolling her eyes at her mother, two elderly couples, grandmothers and grandfathers, a goth girl, mostly in black but with pink accessories, 20-somethings on a date, a blue-haired woman in severe glasses, and a professorly middle-aged man in tweed with a notebook. Cut to interior movie theater, packed audience chatting excitedly. The screen is off camera. As the camera slowly pans the crowd, the theater lights dim, the crowd goes quiet, faces light up, illuminated by a glow from the front of the theater. The camera pans to the front of the theater to reveal not a movie screen, but a stage with a live blonde woman sitting in a pink overstuffed chair. She's holding a cigarette and wearing a pink beret. She opens her mouth to speak, only to be interrupted by a loud record scratch, and then a male narrator's voice. "I'm sorry, I can't keep this up. I'm a philosophy professor, not a script writer or a film producer. I've gotten myself in some trouble because a few months ago I made the mistake of mentioning to some bright and faithful college students that I found a certain hit movie from last summer profoundly philosophical, and here I am. I guess it's my fault, although the students who invited me deserve some of the blame. If there's one important thing to say about the Barbie movie, it is that it was fun. And if there's anything you should know about philosophers, it is that you should never invite them to talk about something that you thought was fun. Another thing to say about the Barbie movie is that it confirms, because it so masterfully uses, the conventions of its artistic genre. Even a creative, fun reinterpretation of a genre must observe the conventions. I can't promise to be fun, but I can observe the conventions of a philosophical discourse. One of the oldest conventions, going back at least to Aristotle, in the opening chapters of major works like the Metaphysics and the De Anima, is to start with the survey of the opinions of his predecessors. Scholars today call that the literature review. So, in order to get my bearings, I begin with this question. Act 1. What have other people said about the Barbie movie? I'm only going to give a few examples, very quickly, and I'm ignoring those who are regular movie critics or who evaluate primarily cinematic qualities. I've chosen strictly from among those of my predecessors attempting some kind of theoretical interpretation, philosophical or theological. So here we go. William Borst, writing in Catholic Journal, interprets the Barbie movie as embracing a dangerous feminist project to diminish marriage and family, especially in distorting and rejecting the ideal of motherhood. Rabbi Dr. Laura Duhan Kaplan, a professor of Jewish studies, writing in her blog Sophia Street, finds the movie not feminist enough. Instead of leading towards fulfillment in equality, it ends disappointingly with women having to step up and take responsibility for their own reproductive health. Abigail Wilkinson Miller, writing a Catholic defense of Barbie in the Jesuit magazine America, acknowledges different senses of feminism and sees a common thread through writer-director Greta Gerwig's other films, not a feminism of independence, but a feminism of givenness and relationship. Kathleen Cavaney, a Boston College theologian, writing in the National Catholic Reporter, interprets Barbie as a version of the story of Adam and Eve's fall from paradise, with Barbie Land as a perfect Eden and the real world as a state fallen from grace. Amy, I have more to go, but it's already interesting, right? The diversity of views and the kinds of people who are responding to this. Amy Wellborn, writing in Catholic World Report, argues that Barbie's story isn't about leaving Eden or rejecting God. It is about rejecting a caricatured, idealized feminist utopia, literally a land of dolls, to become a real human being, accepting fragility, limits, and real responsibility. Literary theorist Olivia Rutigliano, writing in Literary Hub, finds everything about the Barbie movie winsome and philosophically insightful, except Barbie's trajectory of transcending dollhood. Her only disappointment is that the movie has too much humanization at the end. Just a few more. Annie Brownell Crawford, writing in the ecumenical Christian publication Salvo, criticizes Barbie's radical individualism as glorifying an isolated, self-determined agency rooted in existentialism, which she takes to be exemplified by the nihilistic writings of Sartre and Nietzsche. Santiago Ramos, writing in Commonweal, interprets Barbie as sharing a more humane and hopeful version of existentialism, even citing Catholic Gabrielle Marcel. Yet Ramos finds Barbie rejecting something divine, refusing her dependence on her creator and leaving a world of love and joy for something merely human and characterized by death. Dominican brother Charles Marie Rooney, writing in the publication Dominicana, recognizes that the central plot is about Barbie becoming human and that that has existential dimensions. But ultimately, he focuses on a more Aristotelian and Thomistic message, pointing to the need for finding ultimate happiness only in communion with God. I'm going to skip philosopher Slavoj Žižek because he later admitted he didn't watch the film. He was just making stuff up as only he could. But he thought it was Freudian for some reason. So lastly, philosopher Tom McClelland, writing in the blog of the American Philosophical Association, reflects on the difference between implicit theories embedded in art and explicit theories articulated by philosophy. His strong appreciation of the film is based less on its ability to convey any particular message than on its Socratic ability to raise questions. Let these 10 examples or so suffice to show the range and inconsistency of philosophical and theological interpretations of the Barbie movie. The film provokes intellectual interest and can be fairly said to have themes about, say, psychology, feminism, ideology, power structures. Notably, many of the interpreters pay more attention to what individual characters say or to particular scenes, but some interpreters are better than others at putting those in the context of the film's overall plot. The Barbie movie clearly touched on ideas and invited reflection from people who think it is important to take seriously any suggestion of a political, ideological, philosophical, or spiritual message. Although the interpretations do not all agree, they are also not all speaking the same language. Key terms have different connotations or they signify different phenomena for different interpreters, and at least some of the disagreement could be cleared up by defining terms or at least paying attention to the fact that terms can have a flexible range of meanings. Is the Barbie film feminist? Is it existentialist? It kind of depends on what you mean by those terms. For my part, I would say the following about the film. First, it isn't much about psychology, but to the extent that it is, the relevant thinker would be Jung and not Freud. Storytelling and the power of myth, not the pull and complication of sexuality, is closer to the heart of the movie. Second, the movie can be fairly said to be about feminism, but it is not so much a defense or advocacy of any ideology or movement as it is an interpretation of different waves of feminism as impartial and inadequate stages of an ongoing and unfinished story. Finally, indeed, there are deep themes about the purpose and meaning of human life, and while these may be open to Aristotelian interpretations, the language of the film directly implicates existentialism, not in the dismal mode of Sartre or the dangerous mode of Nietzsche, but in the humane, humble, and hopeful mode of Catholic personalists, including, yes, Gabrielle Marcel. I don't arrive at my interpretation simply by finding common ground among the various other interpretations, or by clarifying the meaning of terms to clear up equivocation. Among the interpretations just surveyed, there are genuinely different views expressed, and in offering my own initial sketch, I'm not simply announcing my own perspective, although interpretations tend to tell us more about the interpreter than about the thing interpreted. The diversity of interpretations doesn't only display different ideological or philosophical perspectives, but different modes of interpreting the film. In particular, there are implicitly different ways that interpreters believe that ideas and isms or arguments, the sorts of things that are explicitly expressed in theoretical reflection, can be found embedded in and communicated by a more artistic or literary mode of discourse, like a movie. I think reflecting on how to interpret an artistic work of narrative fiction, like a film or a novel or a short story, is interesting in itself and helpful for ensuring responsible interpretation. So the first main question I asked, what have people already said about the Barbie movie, unearthed different interpretive approaches which give rise to the second question that I want to explore. So Act Two is, how does one philosophically engage a literary work? I find it easiest to respond to this question by telling a story of my own experience. Several years ago, as part of a course on love and friendship, I assigned a short story by André Debus. The title is Adultery, and the main character, Edith, commits that act with three different men, the third time with a disillusioned former priest. As we began discussing this story in class, the students focused on this woman's moral character and the scandal and moral gravity of her actions. Reasonably enough, and reassuring in a way, the overwhelming consensus of the class was that she was wrong, a poor role model, a sinner. Yet sound moral reasoning is not the same as thoughtful reflection on a work of literature, and in this case it actually seemed to be getting in the way of a more sophisticated analysis of the story. The author didn't write the story to tell us that adultery was wrong, nor to defend or praise adultery. The author probably agreed with the students. Indeed, it was a premise of the story drawing on explicitly Catholic language that the woman was indeed sinning and that she was aware of herself as sinning. It was true that she was a sinner, but that wasn't an interesting thing to say about the story, and it seemed tangential to an appreciation of the story as a literary work of art. What the moral judgment of her missed was that the main character, despite her sins, was somehow a sympathetic, perhaps pitiable, and certainly a complex and recognizably human person. If we paid attention to her, we would learn something about the human condition, not even despite but because of her flaws. The first reaction of students, however, was to treat her as a symbol or an example, which hid from them that she was a character with interesting depth. Many of my students in that class were seminarians, and the conversation finally changed when I posed a question. What would you say to this woman if she came to you and asked for spiritual advice? What would you say to her if you heard this story of adultery in the confessional? This question reframed how students interpreted the story. In particular, it helped them to see Edith as someone who deserved careful, attentive, and sensitive attention, not to be reduced to simplistic rules and ideals. Ironically, inviting them to imagine Edith as a real person actually helped them to appreciate her as a character in the story, and to attend to the story as a story of a woman's psychologically and spiritually difficult situation. Moral dogma and pastoral care are not incompatible. Indeed, the former is meant to serve the latter, but the shift from prioritizing pastoral care instead of moral dogma was also a shift that opened up a more reflective literary analysis. Instead of simply adulteress, Edith emerged as someone who sought to love and to be loved, as someone with a context and a story, as someone who is suffering, and someone with a capacity, however misguided or tragically situated, for great generosity. Such a reframing didn't redeem Edith, but it humanized her. And humanizing her in the eyes of readers was also helping the readers to be more observant readers, capable of more interesting reflection about various details of the story, which were, after all, details of Edith's fictional universe, and so the context of Edith's choices and experiences. Some students, for instance, noticed that her behavior confirmed basic anthropological insights about the desire for love and belonging, the nobility of suffering, and the beauty of sacrifice. One student noticed that her three stages of adultery mirrored Aristotle's three types of friendship. Initially, she committed adultery out of revenge upon her cheating husband, adultery of utility. Then she committed it because of the thrill of enjoyment, adultery of pleasure. The final adultery was in the context of sincere, even if injudicious, care of another person, adultery of misconceived excellence. Whether the author of the story had theological anthropology or Aristotelian ethics in mind when he wrote it is beside the point. The author was a good storyteller, attuned to social and psychological dynamics, capable of describing realistic experiences, and his storyteller's intuition led him to describe a scenario that was plausible. It was entirely true to human experience that a woman who experienced what Edith experienced would follow the kind of path described in the story. Human beings have different means of reasoning and can apprehend truth in different modes. By reframing the story of the adulteress, I was not asking students to ignore modes of reasoning that they had developed, such as making sound moral judgments or applying doctrinal principles, but I was inviting them to see that they shouldn't let those modes of reasoning substitute for other modes of reasoning. Narratives have their own logic, and the audience for a narrative has to be attuned to that and use interpretive modes of reasoning that are appropriate to the story. Good storytellers can thus use stories to teach without having a tidy lesson or a clearly stated moral. And that is how we can learn from reading stories, even if their featured characters are not role models or moral exemplars. That's how we can learn from them even through their flaws and the presentation of their flaws. So here's a provisional answer to my question about how philosophers can engage literary work. Literary analysis, by which I don't mean a specialized academic exercise, but simply something like thoughtful reading, is not so simple a matter as applying a dogma or ideology. Theological commitment, moral or psychological theory, political or economic principle, these can all sometimes illuminate dimensions of a story, and academic schools of literary analysis have all developed around these kinds of convictions. But these are not substitutes for reasoning about the story on its own terms. Art has a life of its own, and theories cannot be imposed on art as some sort of independent key to the value and meaning of the art. Flannery O'Connor, a great storyteller and faithful Catholic, often remarked on this. In The Catholic Novelist in the Protestant South, she complained that a certain way of holding religious faith can cloud instead of illuminate literary appreciation and insight. As she put it, the American Catholic trusts the fictional imagination about as little as he trusts anything. Before it's well on its feet, he's busy looking for heresy in it. O'Connor's stories often feature deeply flawed characters who receive unexpected grace from other deeply flawed characters. As a Catholic storyteller whose method of storytelling essentially ruled out easy pieties, she was risking offending especially those of shared and adjacent faith. This challenge of engaging the fictional imagination is surely real for any novelist, including those without religious faith, especially if they are sincere and effective storytellers. They too deserve a fair reading on their own terms, and certainly from Christians, they deserve a fairer reading than shallow heresy hunting. I think this points to a clear principle for interpreting the Barbie movie. Let storytellers be storytellers. The philosophical interpretations I surveyed at the start could fairly easily be sorted into those which take seriously the centrality of the protagonist's dramatic arc, a doll who is awakened to the possibility of becoming and, in the end, does indeed become a living, breathing woman. Those interpretations which ignore this element of the movie or mischaracterize it as a different kind of story, like the story of a fall or the story of a woman trying to learn a new ideology, those treat the actual storyline as superfluous afterthought or as a vehicle for more abstract ideas. It is entirely fair to say that the Barbie movie is a provocation for thoughts about feminism, capitalism, theology, and the like, but the story as a story isn't a theory about those topics, and indeed the story seems to be crafted so that to the extent such topics are explicitly addressed, it is always as part of the context which the main character must negotiate in her central action of the film, which is to become a human being. What I'm proposing, in other words, is that in literary interpretation, as in all other exercises, philosophers should take things for what they are. A literary work is not a philosophical treatise or ideological manifesto, not a theory or an ideology. It is a story. And so a philosophical interpretation must begin by taking it seriously as a story. But this leads to a more fundamental question. For by asking how philosophy can engage literary works, I have been assuming that it can and that it should. Can it and should it? Can lovers of wisdom trust any mythmakers? Do they have a responsibility to take storytelling seriously as storytelling? From our reflections so far, we thus arrive at a third main question, which, with deference to Plato, I will express as follows, and this is Act 3. Shouldn't the poet be banned from the Republic? Philosophy began in suspicion of poetry. A common story of the birth of philosophy in ancient Greece is that it was a rational scientific alternative to supernatural theological myth. That itself is a story designed to flatter modern secular sensibilities. The fact is that ancient philosophy was as much concerned with unseen causes and the nature of divinity as ancient myth, but it did seek these things by a different mode, argument and reason rather than storytelling and imagination. Philosophy's suspicion of storytelling, of myth and poetry, was predicated on a respect and even awe at its power. In Plato's Laws, the Athenian stranger complains that the poets are concerned more with performance than with truth, and so will say contradictory things to move an audience. The poets are a threat, not because they are ineffective, but because they have the power to mislead and confuse. More famously, in The Republic, Plato describes an ancient quarrel between philosophy and poetry, and he argues that because of their ability to shape action and communal identity, in the ideal city, storytellers must be strictly supervised. Poets who will not accept the rule of philosophy, storytelling not ordered to truth and virtue, must be banned from the ideal city. Scholars argue about whether Plato's critique is about poetic speech in general or more about specific poets, Hesiod and Homer and an Athenian culture built up around their views of divine and human nature. But either way, it is clear that poetry in Plato's mind was not a meaningless distraction, a light diversion, or a private pleasure. What Plato meant by poetry was beautiful speech, memorable stories that had force to shape individuals and communities. In its broadest sense, poetry included the public spectacles of tragedies and comedies, and it had a kind of liturgical, almost religious quality. This is why his question is relevant to a discussion of a popular film. In terms of cultural function, what Plato called poetry would today have a lot more in common with a blockbuster movie or a buzzworthy Netflix series than with a few verses in a literary magazine. Poetry is storytelling, and storytelling informs a sense of identity and purpose. It communicates habits of thought and feeling. It conveys a view of the nature of the world and its possibilities. Plato criticized poetry as a threatening mode of education. Poetry was dangerous precisely because of its power to form hearts and minds. And yet, even as attributed to Plato, the critique of poetry is sometimes exaggerated. In the Ion, Plato has Socrates reveal that the poet does not have knowledge in the strict sense that would satisfy Socratic dialectic. But he acknowledges that the poet and the interpreter of poet has a kind of knack or skill, and perhaps even divine inspiration. In other words, an ability to communicate truth that is somehow other than philosophical knowledge. Even in Plato's Laws, one of the key methodological points of the Athenian stranger is that an effective law is more than a clearly formulated rule. It is a rule prefaced by a certain kind of rationale, not a deductive argument or proof, but a persuasive, motivating overture or prelude. A good law defines a rule and prepares the heart of the citizen to understand and accept the reasonableness of the rule. Plato says all discourses and vocal exercises have preludes and overture, which are a sort of artistic beginnings intended to help the strain which is to be performed. Effective legislation and governance, in other words, requires a kind of storytelling, and the legislator and the ruler must be a kind of storyteller. Even in The Republic, there is a manifest tension between what Plato says about storytellers and his own masterful use of storytelling. The Republic is such a memorable masterpiece because of particular compelling fictions, artful illustrations, metaphors and allegories, often in vivid detail. Some of you might remember Gyges Ring, or the allegory of the cave, or the account of the tyrant's soul as an insatiable many-headed beast. The philosopher who would ban the poet from the Republic was never a more artful poet than when he was writing the Republic. He was such an artful poet that we can get caught up in his work and forget that he was a poet. I've been focusing on Plato's question about poetry and on Plato's answer. Yet the patron of this lecture series was a Christian theologian, and so in the name of St. Thomas, I ask a fourth question. This is Act 4. What does a Christian theological perspective have to bear on Plato's regard for poetry? The question of the relation between Athens and Jerusalem is not only about reason versus revelation. It is also about argument versus storytelling. God's particular revelation to the Jews is that the Jews have a particular relation to him, and this is conveyed through a story. That story of a past fall and a promise of redemption is authoritative, and theorizing may be used to articulate it and illuminate it, but never to replace it. Christian theologians thus inherit more of Plato's respect for poetry's power, but with a new regard that God has offered the ultimate story within which all other human activity takes place. Aquinas is famous for his clear analytic mind, but he was of necessity a lover of literature. He read and commented on the Psalms, he wrote poetry, and he was fully aware that in rational animals, reason is moved and moves us in various ways other than by philosophical argument. When you think of argument, you might think first of demonstrations, proofs which lead to certainty. That's the production of knowledge in the strict sense. Yet philosophers and theologians must also be able to reason before and without demonstration, inquiry more indirect that produces beliefs not yet necessarily proven. And besides these, there are ways to marshal probable evidence and to sway opinions. All of these could be considered forms of argument, scientific, dialectical, and rhetorical, with parts of logic or reasoning about reasoning dedicated to each one, respectively, Aristotle's books on the Analytics, the Topics, and the Rhetoric. But reason extends beyond even these types of logic and argument, and Aquinas says that reasoning sometimes moves us by nothing more than a kind of regard or esteem resulting from the way something is represented. By a representation there, Aquinas means a more familiar image, which may point beyond itself to something otherwise more remote and difficult to grasp. This can be a whole work, a story, a song, or a play, or it could be a simple metaphor. Fittingly, expounding on this point, Aquinas uses a vivid metaphor here, noting that the presentation of food can influence whether we perceive it as appetizing or disgusting. Presumably, the culinary art teaches not only the steps of preparing the contents of a meal, but also how the meal will be presented. When this is done with objects of intellectual appetite, when ideas are presented in a linguistic context that makes them attractive to consume, it is governed by the art of poetry. For the poet's vocation, says Aquinas, is to guide us toward what is virtuous by some attractive representation. All of that is at the beginning of Aquinas' commentary on one of Aristotle's logical works. Narrative, poetry, storytelling, these are not argument or inquiry, but they are modes of reasoning aimed to illuminate the soul. And in some of the most important matters, they are the most powerful modes, much more powerful than theoretical argument. All parents are natural Platonists in the home, supervising stories, carefully guarding the media narratives that are allowed to shape their children. Children need to learn to think about themselves and the world around them, but before parents teach them theories and principles, they tell them stories. So while it might seem that the Christian West ultimately rejected Plato's suspicion of poetry, on the question of poetry, Jerusalem has very much in common with Athens. The essence of Judaism and Christianity is that God himself has supervised the storytelling. He has issued the definitive story, and that all other modes of reasoning are now somehow ultimately in the service of that story. Hence, orthodoxy, creeds, and dogmatic theology, all serving to explicate the God-given salvation narrative. One may say that the very idea of a biblical canon, which books are in, which books are out, is about supervising the poets. Having an authoritative story also means that Christians can be remarkably open to stories that do not claim to be canonical or divinely inspired. Pope Francis described the significance of literary interpretation in a recent letter called On the Role of Literature in Formation, published that in July of this year. Reading literature, he argues, helps to form the soul. Literature thus has to do, in one way or another, I'm quoting him, with our deepest desires in this life, for on a profound level, literature engages our concrete existence with its innate tensions, desires, and meaningful experiences. Francis specifically encourages Christians to engage with non-Christian literature as an extension of the church's evangelical mission to prepare the way for Christ by awakening the question of what it means to be human. Here's a quotation from Francis again. Literature proves essential for believers who sincerely seek to enter into dialogue with the culture of their time, or simply with the lives and experiences of other people. With good reason, he says, the Second Vatican Council observed that literature and art seek to penetrate our nature and throw light on our suffering and joy, our needs and potentialities. Many of the emphases of Francis's letter are directly relevant to interpreting the Barbie movie. The importance of entering into other perspectives and engaging culture, the value of literature for revealing the limits of theory, even he's explicit about themes of fleshliness, anxiety, and crisis. Literature, he says, thus teaches us how to look and see, to discern and explore the reality of individuals and situations as a mystery, charged with a surplus of meaning that can only be partially understood through categories, explanatory schemes, linear dynamics of causes and effects, means and ends. Francis's recent letter came actually 25 years after John Paul II's letter to artists in April of 1999. John Paul II, as Carol Wojtyla, was a poet, an actor, and a playwright. And as Pope, he wanted to encourage artists and all who are passionately dedicated to the search for the new epiphanies of beauty to offer their works as gifts to the world. Specifically, in the name of the church, he encouraged non-Christian works of art. And here's a passage from John Paul II's letter to artists. Even beyond its typically religious expressions, true art has a close affinity with the world of faith, so that, even in situations where culture and the church are far apart, art remains a kind of bridge to religious experience. Insofar as it seeks the beautiful, fruit of an imagination which rises above the everyday, art is by its nature a kind of appeal to the mystery. Every genuine inspiration for an artist contains some tremor of that breath with which the creator spirit suffused the work of creation from the very beginning. I'm going to continue reading this passage because I think it's artfully done. Overseeing the mysterious laws governing the universe, the divine breath of the creator spirit reaches out to human genius and stirs its creative power. He touches it with a kind of inner illumination which brings together the sense of the good and the beautiful, and he awakens energies of mind and heart which enable it to conceive an idea and give it form in a work of art. It is right, then, to speak, even if only analogically, of moments of grace. Remember, he's talking about non-Christian artists receiving moments of grace through their art, because the human being is able to experience in some way the absolute who is utterly beyond. Thus, John Paul II. Dorothy Sayers regarded the artist as a clear manifestation of the imago Dei, indeed argued that we are all artists insofar as agents of making, including the making of the choices that constitute the course of our lives, we reflect and participate in God's work as a creator. We share in the mind of the maker, which gives the title to her book. So I have recommended that thoughtful interpretation respects a story as a story, and that even a Christian interpretation respects the story on its own terms, trusting that a good story, without necessarily being aware of, but simply in the act of telling a story, offers an image of the divine author. This is the spirit in which I address the last question, my fifth act, and the one many of you have been waiting for. Act 5, what story does the Barbie movie tell? Distilled to its essence, Barbie is the story of a doll becoming a human being. This is a challenging story to tell because a compelling protagonist is usually already human. In Barbie, we have a character who is not yet human, so in a sense, not yet fully a character for much of the story. To appreciate the narrative challenge this presents, note that in another story of a toy becoming real, Pinocchio, the protagonist already has the full range of consciousness. Indeed, he is more like a human trapped in the body of a toy as a metaphor for an unruly child. Pinocchio is the story of a puppet becoming a real boy, but really it is the story of a boy becoming emotionally and morally mature, practicing enough virtue to accept his identity as a son. Barbie is different. She is a doll, and she is an adult doll. Her becoming human is not about developing in virtue, but about waking up to the very conditions of virtue, the condition of embodied rational agency. Since the doll is Barbie, her story is the story of becoming a real woman. While Pinocchio's growth is necessarily moral, then, Barbie's is both existential, the discovery of consciousness, and deeply physical, an experience of bodiliness and the responsibility of bodiliness, especially the potential for death and for new life. The crucial movement toward human self-consciousness for Barbie partly involves a rejection of what she had taken for granted. Maybe the things that you thought made you you aren't really you. What had defined the doll in Barbie Land were possessions and prestige and a utopian or ideological view of happiness through possessions and prestige. What Barbie comes to accept as elements of genuine human consciousness are mystery and wonder and responsibility for making choices, which of course are both made concrete in the acceptance of biological bodiliness. If there is a lesson or moral in the Barbie movie, it is something like this. One realizes oneself not through objects, ideology, or abstract ideas, but in wondering at the natures of things, appreciating their beauty, and accepting the limits, responsibility, and dependence of embodied life. On this interpretation, the Barbie movie is distinctly not individualistic, nor darkly existential. If it is existentialist, it is in the manner of Gabriel Marcel. Marcel distinguished the abstract goal of equality from the real experience of community, which he called fraternity, and I will simply extend also to sorority. Says Marcel, fraternity, or sorority, excludes the spirit of abstraction and the ideologies in which that spirit always tends to be embodied. For that matter, as an exercise in sorority, Barbie is not a feminist. The character Barbie is not a feminist in any of the usual ideological senses of the term. Or rather, if the movie is feminist, it is so in the way that seeks to prioritize female agency and shared experience and not define women in terms of movements, power structures, and ideological convictions. It is part of the cleverness of the film that it acknowledges feminism as a plot point. Indeed, it acknowledges different versions or waves of feminism as part of the history of the Barbie toy and its role, real and perceived, in American culture. But then in the context of the film, feminism is not the governing worldview, or rather, feminism survives mainly by being treated as an un-yet-finished story about changing imperfect attempts to capture the experience and challenges of women in mass culture. Mass culture is also a phrase from Gabriel Marcel. I have reached a point, however, where I fear I will be like one of the other Kens in the brief-lived Kenland, who insists on explaining the Godfather movie. Another Barbie asks him to start the movie over and just talk through the whole thing. But her question is posed with, shall we say, Socratic irony. I will not talk through the whole movie, but having proposed my interpretive hypothesis, I can demonstrate its power briefly by testing it against what I would have often been regarded as the most problematic or dissatisfying moments of the film. First, there are several scenes that viewers have wanted to interpret out of context as somehow capturing the message of the movie. The opening scene, where the introduction of the massive Barbie doll leads little girls to smash their more traditional baby dolls. The human Sasha's, she's the teenage girl, her rant to Barbie about how harmful Barbie has been to women. She calls Barbie a fascist. And Sasha's mother's Gloria's long complaint about the plight, tensions, and contradictions of being a woman. Each of these moments plays an important role in plot development, and they all have a context. Barbie was perceived as replacing more traditional family values girl play. That was a common conservative critique of Barbie when she was introduced. Sasha is an angry, immature, and alienated teenager. And Gloria, her mother, is exhausted and struggling and articulating a genuine feeling of frustration. But none of these are the moral of the story. And each advances the plot of Barbie, starting as a ridiculously idealized plastic doll subject to other people's ideologies and emerging from dollhood into complicated humanity. Another common misinterpretation is that the film does not value or show marriage and family. An important subplot is the healing of the relationship between Sasha and her mother, but Sasha's father plays almost no role in that reconciliation, or no apparent role, and Barbie seems to have a chance to love Ken, but she declines to. As for the human family, there is a husband-father. He simply plays a minor role in the mother-daughter relationship, which is the real focus of the movie. And the reason Barbie doesn't love Ken at the end is that she is becoming human and he is not. Ken was the scene-stealing comic relief, but he is still a caricature of manhood and is not lovable as a human could be lovable. In short, the film does not reject marriage and family. It simply appropriately centers the female characters, especially the main character, who is becoming a woman. For me, one of the most problematic lines in the movie is when Barbie is talking to her human maker, Ruth Handler, and is about to make her decisive choice to become human. I don't know what Ruth was like in real life, but in the film, her character exudes peacefulness and generosity. She has a grandmotherly aura. It is in this conversation that many of the film's genuine lessons are most fully articulated. Ruth gently encourages Barbie to weigh the cost of rejecting abstractions and embracing mortality. Humans only have one ending. Ideas live forever. But humans, not so much. Barbie is willing to accept the burden of death because she is attracted to the possibilities of human consciousness, to subjectivity instead of objectivity. I want to do the imagining. I don't want to be the idea. The line that I initially struggled with, however, was this one. Barbie says, I want to be a part of the people that make meaning, not the thing that's made. In common American parlance, talk about making meaning suggests to me relativism and individualism. The proper way to think about meaning is as something discovered, not constructed. But that is my hang-up on a common phrase. In the context of the movie, that is not what Barbie is suggesting. She is saying that she wants to be the artist, not the art. She wants to be the subject, not the object. The people that make meaning, those are the poets. The Greek verb poiein means to make. A poem is literally that which is made. Barbie is saying that she doesn't want to be a poem, she wants to be the poet. Barbie is a story about a woman becoming capable of being a storyteller. Only such a creature can participate in seeking a purpose, pursuing what the Greeks would call a telos, and the Romans a finis, or in the French of Gabriel Marcel, fin. Speaking of which, interior theater, medium view of stage. The woman in the pink beret takes a long drag on the cigarette, stands up, smiles, winks, and says, "Welcome." Fade to black. Title card, the end.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.